Hello and welcome to Inside Education, the programme that brings you news and insights from education from an Irish perspective. My name is Sean Delaney and you can find out more about Inside Education and download podcasts of previous programmes at insideed.com. Later on this week's programme, I'll speak to an expert on intercultural education about how teachers can support linguistic and ethnic minority children in their classrooms. But first this week, I return to the topic of last week's programme, Universal Design for Learning. David Rose from CAST was in Ireland last week as a guest of the National Centre for Excellence in Universal Design, supported by the Technological University for Dublin Alliance. Towards the end of the interview on this programme, David Rose spoke about a National Instructional Readings Accessibility Standard in the United States, which essentially states that if schools assign printed textbooks for their students, these are deemed not to be sufficiently flexible, and by law, the school must provide alternatives. But there was a two-word phrase in the same law which David Rose welcomed in particular.
In that law is an interesting two-word phrase that marks, I think, for me, a watershed in the way we think about kids and their education system. And that is that alternative versions, like an audio book or a digital book, a braille book, all of those are alternate versions. They must now be provided in a timely fashion, meaning when other kids get their printed books, some kids must get these alternate versions. Those kids that must get them free of charge may have a designation, which is new, which is that they have a print disability. And that little phrase, I think, is a crack that's opening up a very different view of the landscape of education and certainly of textbooks.
That was where we ended up on last week's programme. So why does David believe that the phrase print disability is changing the landscape of education and of textbooks?
Because what it does is it says, this is to replace a word like learning disability. What it says is that not that this kid has a learning disability. Very different to say they have a print disability, because it co-locates the problem. It says essentially that the problem is in their interaction with the medium of instruction, in this case print, and that print isn't very good for some kids. Terrific for some, awful for others, and we are disabling some kids preferentially if we only give printed books. And now there's a word. A kid may have a print disability, in which case the school is required to give them an alternate version. That's a sea change. But the sea change isn't just in the getting a digital book. The sea change is in understanding the nature of why they're not learning well. And it's not because there's something irremediable about them as learners, but something remediable about the way in which we're teaching. That we need to not use print with them because it won't work well is a big sea change. And I think that will expand to see, oh, wow, this is the way we need to think of it. So now at CAST, we typically talk about schools as being print disabled. If a school only uses print still, because some still do and they don't really haven't responded to these new laws, schools have print disabilities. And what does that mean? It means that they're not very effective with some kids. And that orientation, a change to seeing schools as being print disabled, is still new, but it's gaining traction. And it's the right way that educators need to think. That is, we need to think about what we're not doing well first before we start blaming kids and sending them to diagnostic facilities. First thing we need to do is say, is our school disabled? And one of the ways that schools are disabled is by having too much print materials or exclusively print materials. So because of these laws, publishers are providing alternate versions, which, for example, read themselves aloud. If a kid's not a very good decoder, the book decodes itself. If English isn't your first language, the book can digitally be switched to Spanish in an instant. So the materials are looking quite different. They're digital, virtually. In fact, by law, you must be providing them to make sure that all your students can learn, you know, science, geography, history. So the materials are looking quite different. And some of the materials are online. So online is getting to be a big thing in the U.S. Some of it is terrible, just to be honest. It's just really warmed over textbooks and workbooks put on the web. It's really not anything any good. But some of the stuff is interactive, exciting, simulations. Kids are taking virtual field trips. And those are part of what makes schools who don't do these things look print disabled. It looks like, wow, your kids are not doing any experiments. They're not trying out the salinity of the pond and trying to figure out how to fix it. They're just reading out of a book. It just looks increasingly too regressive and certainly, actually now, actually illegal to do that.
And for children who don't use print, is there an argument that they're being deprived of something? That they're, because every medium has its affordances and its drawbacks, and there are certain things in print, say, that aren't in an audio version of a book. And are some children being deprived of that if they're not allowed to read print in school, or, you know, if other media are emphasized?
I'm glad you asked that question, because it's an important distinction between print and text. We, like your question implies, think it's very important that kids learn to be able to comprehend text. But text can be either in print or digital, for example. In print, all of the processing has to happen in the child's head. That is, they have to decode words, they have to have vocabulary in their mind, they have to have background knowledge. All of those things are things that are required of the reader. In a digital version of that same book, again, the text is exactly the same. But now we have many different routes to get to the underlying meaning and to get to apply my comprehension strategies. So the book can provide decoding support. So if you can't decode a word, you can just click on it and it will decode itself. And if you don't know the word's meaning, you can just click on the word and press a button and say, what's that word mean? And background knowledge can be embedded in the book, only there if you need it. I didn't grow up in this culture. I don't know what baseball really is. I can get that information quickly. So that we have routes now, new routes, to high levels of comprehension, high demand for comprehension, for students who may have poor entry skills like decoding or vocabulary, and before they were shut out from doing the high-level comprehension. And I think you know this too, Sean, that we used to dumb down texts and say kids are going to read at their decoding level. So if, and often in my own teaching, I had kids in the ninth grade who were second-grade decoders. And so I was told to find, you know, second-grade level reading books, which of course was terrible for them. They hated them. But there was no alternative because they really couldn't decode much more. But now, actually, the decoding can be outsourced, just like, you know, you wear your glasses. We could say, well, I'm sorry, you can't wear your glasses when you're reading. You got to do it the natural way or something. You know, there's only one way to, you know, look at things, and that's without glasses. And so we can't do that. And now there's actually ways to handle decoding. But you also said something I wanted to go after, which is we actually don't think audiobooks are reading. The good thing about a digital book that voices itself is that the text is there, and in fact it highlights words as you're reading and so on. An audiobook, the text is not there. So in fact, you're not confronting text and not learning about text. Audiobooks are part of these new laws for students who are blind. And there's reasons why an audiobook can be a preferential medium for them. But we wouldn't recommend them for a child with dyslexia, for example, because, again, it disenfranchises them from text. So it's not like there's not a good teacher that's aware of what's the right format for this kid. By the way, I should be careful, too, even for a blind student, the books can be produced in Braille, including electronic Braille, And that is a better medium, too, than an audiobook. Unless, and you said this, depends on what you're doing. If the play is a dramatic, if it's a dramatic play, rather, then the audio is the right medium. If you're doing Shakespeare and you want to hear Shakespeare, it's better to use an audio than a printed version. And the best of all is to do them both and to see, wow, when you read Shakespeare yourself, it's quite different than when you hear it as a play, and they're both really rich for very different reasons. And literate people recognize those differences and enjoy them both, I think, and schools should be able to do that. I'll tell you an interesting thing that people aren't aware of in this regard, often aren't, and that is that an individual who's blind, you would think that they would prefer an audio recording of a novel, for example, or Shakespeare, because it's rich and full of acting. But actually, this is a good example of understanding the difference among the media. What you like about reading a novel is that you are imagining what's going on, creating your own scenes and characters as they're described in the novel. But it's a very interactive thing with the authorship, which is very different than an actual play or movie. In fact, sometimes you go to a movie of a novel you've read and you hate it because the character doesn't look right and the scenes are not what you imagine. Well, it's interesting. When a person's blind, they will prefer a digitized voice, which a lot of people find, and you know, still not quite right. But because the digitized voice is much more like text, because it doesn't have the, what's the word for inflection. Intonation and inflection. So they get to do that just like you do when you read. So blind people are actually turn out to be just like us. They want to actually read novels by going right to the text, although in their case it's spoken text, but without the inflection. They choose not, this doesn't always happen, but it happens very commonly. They said, I'll do the interpretation. I think actually that goes to the main point, is what we want is people to make the interpretations of things. And when we eliminate that, we actually depress the amount of education that's going on. And blind people are the same. Let me do the interpreting. You just give me the text, but I can't see, so you can't just give it to me in print. But if you give me digital text, then I'll be able to read like you do.
Do you think that every child should achieve the same objectives in school? Or should the objectives or learning outcomes that every student achieves differ? Should it differ from student to student?
That's a complicated question. I think there are some objectives which we really should say we want everybody to get to. And those need to be stated broadly so that they allow multiple ways to get there. So it's, you know, just like a mountain that has multiple trails to get there. So we need to say everybody needs to be able to be persuasive of other people, for example. And it may be that the best medium for you is writing, but it may be that the best medium for you is making a film, or it may be the best thing is a cartoon or whatever. But persuasion is really important. And even setting up that everyone should do some of each of those medium is a good thing. But some people may go much more deeply into film than into text. And we may differentiate the sort of rigor and standards to which they get there. But no one should escape from learning how to be persuasive, and usually using multiple media. But then a classroom should show some differentiation where kids recognize that Sally, boy, if you're going to write an advertising campaign, you want Sally on your team because her illustrations are so powerful. And you want Charlie to be on because his writing is so beautiful and so on. That kind of thing, the teamwork is what we really want to get to.
Okay, we're coming near the end, David. There's one question, and it's a huge question, but if you could even just touch on it. And it is the whole area of neuropsychology, which is an area that you're interested in. And I'm kind of interested in what kind of insights can teachers take from neuropsychology to influence their practice?
Well, there's a few things to learn from neuroscience. Let me say one that comes to my mind. We often talk about how it's difficult for us to get some students to learn, for example. And what you find in the neuroscience is actually that the brain is so well constructed for learning that it's nearly impossible to stop it from learning. And in fact, it learns all night. And I sometimes challenge my students with the following, so try it at home. For the next 20 seconds, try not to learn anything. I don't want to take dead air time, but if you tried for 20 seconds not to learn anything, you would find out, oh my God, I don't know how to do that. The nervous system is just this incredibly exquisite machine, that's a bad word for it, biological machine, that is designed for learning, and it learns. So it's a mistake to say, A, that Billy can't learn, or that I can't get Billy to learn. Well, that's closer to the reality. But our job as educators is to, in fact, engage that system to learn the things that are most important to learn. It is learning. Kids are learning every instant they're in your classroom. And what good teachers do is guide toward, these are the things we really learn in our culture that are important. These are the things that will be valuable for you in the future. These are the things that if you invest in them, you'll get better at, and you'll be able to do other things. So I think of teachers, again, largely emphasizing that emotional part, teachers are mobilizing the learning. They're guiding it toward important things versus unimportant things. I think that's better, though, and more accurate than thinking Billy's not a very good learner. There's nothing I've ever seen in the neurosciences that suggests that kids' brains aren't good learning. They're exquisitely good learners, but they're often not learning the things we intend. They're busy learning other things. That's why good teachers are teachers who know about affect and emotion, to say, those are the ways we mobilize a brain, to say, these are the things we are important. And by the way, I think the most important way teachers do that is by providing models that their students can see. I want to be like her. I want to be like her means I'm willing to put myself out to learn the things that she thinks are important, because that's how I can get to be there. That's why one of the reasons, even though CAST is a technology organization, we think the human interaction, teachers with kids, is so important, because nobody wants to grow up to be a computer. It's not in their, you know, in their frame of what they want to be, but they do want to grow up to be like other people they admire. So for me, having teachers in your classroom that you admire is the strongest possible thing, because that's what guides you toward things that are of value.
So if David Rose is right, teachers need to have little fear of being replaced by computers anytime soon. You're listening to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Another topic that has preoccupied many teachers and is likely to continue to concern us for the foreseeable future is the education of refugees and ethnic and linguistic minority children in our schools. In order to find out more about this topic, I spoke to Dr. Barbara O'Toole, an expert in the area. Barbara O'Toole is the director of the Intercultural Education Master's Degree in the Merino Institute of Education. When I spoke to Barbara recently, I first asked her to tell me what kind of matters teachers need to think about in relation to educating refugee children and other ethnic and linguistic minority children in schools.
I would see the two areas as quite separate, really, because I think the needs of refugee children are going to be quite distinct. We are going to be taking in up to 4,000 refugees in the next couple of years in Ireland. And I think it's really important that schools are going to be prepared to teach children and young people, many of whom will have been through difficult experiences. The schools are going to be the places where many of those children and young people are going to be encountering Irish culture and Irish society for the first time. So I think that there is a real onus on us as educators to think about this now so that we are prepared for when the children and young people arrive in schools, and to think about the needs of those students linguistically, culturally, educationally. And I think that it's a very broad area. And I see it as quite distinct from the whole question of how teachers can address the needs of linguistic minorities.
If we stay for the moment then with the children of ethnic and linguistic minorities, what does it mean to be a child of an ethnic or a linguistic minority in an Irish school?
I think that it probably is a different experience for a child or a young person depending on the school that they go to, because some schools have a higher concentration than others of students from linguistic minorities. And I think that some schools have excellent practice in that area. And there's a lot, I think, that we can learn from those schools that are doing the job very well. Now, I know that from the last census in 2011, there are 182 different languages in Ireland, which is a huge number. And I think that there are particular aspects of EAL pedagogy that teachers...
EAL is English as an additional language.
Yes, yes. That teachers really need to be clued into, particularly now, because since the recession, there has been quite a cutback in specialist EAL support in schools. So most of this work is going to fall to the mainstream teacher. And I think that if I was to draw broad brushstrokes around that, the first element that I would emphasise would be the silent phase, that an EAL learner who is new to the language, new to the culture, is very likely to go through a period which is called the silent phase, where they don't speak. Now, when they go home, they're speaking fluently in their first language, but when they're in class, they're silent. And sometimes teachers can be quite surprised by this unless they're aware of the silent phase. Sometimes teachers are worried about trauma, or they're worried about selective mutism. But in 99% of the cases, the silent phase will resolve itself when the child is ready to speak. And teachers can be really surprised at what happens, because one day there's a child in the class who says nothing, and the next day there's this apparent fluency. It's like a tap has been turned on. And the reason for that is that the child has been internally preparing for the new language. And I see it more as an inner rehearsal phase rather than a silent phase, because I think it's a very active part of the child's learning. So the child is absorbing the new language, but also is orientating him or herself to the new culture. So there's a lot of work going on. So when the child then starts to speak in class...
And just before we move on to when they start to speak, the silent phase, can that last, or the rehearsal phase, as you're calling it, can that last for, what kind of periods are we talking about?
It can vary. Teachers have told me of some children that they've had who it may take 9 months to a year. That would be unusual. That would be quite a lengthy silent phase. Sometimes it can last only 3 or 4 weeks. So anything in between that. And it's really important that the teacher doesn't put pressure on the child to speak, because the child will speak when they're ready. And to include the child as much as possible, because it's really important that even if the child is not verbally taking part in the class, that the teacher includes the child as much as possible in everything that's going on, through nonverbal communication, through illustrating, through gestures, having a visual timetable so that the child can follow everything that's happening, because the child will be following, but will be doing it in a way that's not productive, verbally productive.
I think that's really important, because that experience would be quite different to the experience that teachers might have, say, of maybe teaching foreign learners of English on a summer programme or something like that, where it's a concentrated period and where they almost have to talk, whereas
that the school experience is quite different.
Yes, because if a student is here for a few weeks to learn English, they're here with a peer group. They know that they're going back to their own country. So the circumstances are very different and their relationship with English is very different. They're learning it as a hobby. Whereas the EAL learner from an ethnic minority, they are here in a very different relationship with English. They know that they're here for probably the mid to long term. They have left a lot behind them. So there's a lot of new learning happening, not just for that student, but for the entire family.
And it's not just language.
And it's not just language. That's right.
Okay. So then when the children begin to talk in class,
yes.
what does a teacher need to look out for at that stage?
So at that stage then, now Jim Cummins, I think, has two very helpful kind of stages that he points to. The first one after that follows from the silent phase is social and conversational language. And at that stage then, some of the writers call that playground language, because that's the language that the child will pick up informally from talking to peers. And so it's the language of chatting to friends, it's the language of playing, it's the language that might be heard on the TV. And within 2 years, the student is socially and conversationally fluent. And so sometimes teachers might think, you know, if a student comes in on a Monday and talks really fluently about the football game they played on the weekend or the trip they took to the shopping centre, and the teacher thinks, oh, that's great, that student's making great progress, is really able to put a coherent conversation together. But then if that same student were to go and write about that experience later in the day, there could be a marked gap between what they're able to talk about and what they're able to write. And sometimes, and Cummins points this out, that social and conversational fluency can mask lack of academic language proficiency. So the conversational language can be learned anywhere, but the academic language proficiency can only be learned in the classroom. So if teachers are not tuned into that and are not aware of the need to develop that, what it can open up is an achievement gap between the EAL learner and their English-speaking peers.
So what can a teacher do then to support the child develop this academic language?
In order to teach academic language, first of all, teachers have to know what it is. Academic language is the academic register of a school. So it would be the kind of language that a student would need in order to hypothesise, to argue a point, to persuade, to do the more academic parts of school.
And that was Barbara O'Toole from the Merino Institute of Education speaking on a topic that we'll be returning to on a future edition of the programme. But that's all we have time for on this week's programme. I want to thank my guests, David Rose and Barbara O'Toole. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to or download podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.